Katie knew that Kevin was watching her from inside the car, but she pretended not to notice. Rachel returned with her business card and handed it over. "I usually don't work on Sundays or Mondays," she said. Katie nodded. "I'll give you a call." Behind her, she heard the door open, and Kevin was standing in the doorway. He usually didn't come inside, and her heart pounded. She slipped her jacket back on, trying to control the trembling of her hands. Then she turned and smiled. Chapter 18. The snow was falling harder as Kevin Tierney pulled the car into the driveway. There were bags of groceries in the back seat, and Kevin grabbed three of them before walking toward the door. He'd said nothing on the drive from the salon, had said little to her in the grocery store. Instead, he'd walked beside her as she scanned the shelves looking for sales and trying not to think about the phone in her pocket. Money was tight, and Kevin would be angry if she spent too much. Their mortgage took nearly half his salary, and credit card bills consumed another chunk. Most of the time they had to eat in, but he liked restaurant-type meals, with a main course and two side dishes and sometimes a salad. He refused to eat leftovers, and it was hard to make the budget stretch. She had to plan the menu carefully, and she cut coupons from the newspaper. When Kevin paid for the groceries, she handed him the change from the salon and the receipt. He counted the money, making sure everything was there. At home, she rubbed her arms to stay warm. The house was old, and frigid air wormed its way through the window seams and beneath the front door. The bathroom floor was cold enough to make her feet ache, but Kevin complained about the cost of heating oil and never let her adjust the thermostat. When he was at work, she wore a sweatshirt and slippers around the house, but when he was home, he wanted her to look sexy. Kevin placed the bags of groceries on the kitchen table. She put her bags beside his as he moved to the refrigerator. Opening the freezer, he pulled out a bottle of vodka and a couple of ice cubes. He dropped the cubes into a glass and poured the vodka. The glass was nearly full by the time he stopped pouring. Leaving her alone, he went to the living room, and she heard the television come on and the sounds of ESPN. The announcer was talking about the Patriots and the playoffs and the chances of winning another Super Bowl. Last year, Kevin had gone to a Patriots game. He'd been a fan since childhood. Katie slipped her jacket off and reached into the pocket. She had, she suspected, a couple of minutes, and she hoped it was enough. After peeking in the living room, she hurried to the sink. In the cupboard below, there was a box of SOS scrubbing pads. She placed the cell phone at the bottom of the box and put the pads over the top of it. She closed the cupboard quietly before grabbing her jacket, hoping her face wasn't flushed, praying he hadn't seen her. With a long breath to steel herself, she looped it over her arm, carrying it through the living room toward the foyer closet. The room seemed to stretch as she moved through it, like a room viewed through a funhouse mirror at a carnival. But she tried to ignore the sensation. She knew he'd be able to see through her, to read her mind and know what she'd done, but he never turned away from the television. Only when she was back in the kitchen did her breathing begin to slow. She began to unpack the groceries, still feeling dazed, but knowing she had to act normal. Kevin liked a tidy house, especially the kitchen and bathrooms. She put away the cheese and eggs in their separate compartments in the refrigerator. She pulled the old vegetables from the drawer and wiped it down before putting the new vegetables on the bottom. She kept out some green beans and found a dozen red potatoes in a basket on the pantry floor. She left a cucumber on the counter, along with iceberg lettuce and a tomato for a salad. The main course was marinated strip steaks. She'd put the steaks in the marinade the day before, red wine, orange juice, grapefruit juice, salt, and pepper. The acidity of the juices made the meat tender and gave it extra flavor. It was in a casserole dish on the bottom shelf of the refrigerator. She put the rest of the groceries away, rotating the older items to the front, then folded the bags and put them under the sink. From a drawer, she removed a knife. The cutting board was beneath the toaster, and she set that near the burner. She cut the potatoes in half, only enough for the two of them. She oiled a baking pan, turned the oven on, and seasoned the potatoes with parsley, salt, pepper, and garlic. They would go in before the steaks, and she would have to reheat them. The steaks needed to be broiled. Kevin liked his salads finely diced, with blue cheese crumbles and croutons, and Italian dressing. She cut the tomato in half and cut a quarter of the cucumber before wrapping the remainder in plastic wrap and putting it back in the refrigerator. As she opened the door, she noticed Kevin in the kitchen behind her, leaning against the door jamb that led to the dining room. He took a long drink, finishing his vodka and continuing to watch her, his presence all-encompassing. He didn't know she'd left the salon, she reminded herself. He didn't know she'd bought a cell phone. He would have said something. He would have done something. "Steaks tonight?" he finally asked. She closed the refrigerator door and kept moving, trying to appear busy, staying ahead of her fears. "Yes," she said. "I just turned on the oven, so it'll be a few minutes. I've got to put the potatoes in first." Kevin stared at her.
"Your hair looks good," he said.
"Thank you. She did a good job." Katie went back to the cutting board. She began to cut the tomato, making a long slice.
"Not too big," he said,
nodding in her direction. "I know," she said. She smiled as he moved to the freezer again. Katie heard the clink of cubes in his glass.
"What did you talk about when you were getting your hair done?"
"Not much, just the usual. You know how stylists are. They'll talk about anything." He shook his glass. She could hear the cubes clink against the glass.
"Did you talk about me?"
"No," she said. She knew he wouldn't have liked that, and he nodded. He pulled the bottle of vodka out again and set it beside his glass on the counter before moving behind her. He stood, watching over her shoulder as she diced the tomatoes. Small pieces, no larger than a pea. She could feel his breath on her neck and tried not to cringe as he placed his hands on her hips. Knowing what she had to do, she set the knife down and turned toward him, putting her arms around his neck. She kissed him with a little tongue, knowing he wanted her to, and didn't see the slap coming until she felt the sting against her cheek. It burned, hot and red, sharp. Bee stings.
"You made me waste my entire afternoon,"
he shouted at her. He gripped her arms tight, squeezing hard. His mouth was contorted, his eyes already bloodshot. She could smell the booze on his breath, and spittle hit her face.
"My only day off, and you picked that day to get your damn hair done in the middle of the city, and then go grocery shopping."
She wiggled, trying to back away, and he finally let her go. He shook his head, the muscle of his jaw pulsing.
"Did you ever stop to think that I might have wanted to relax today? Just take it easy on my only day off?"
"I'm sorry," she said, holding her cheek. She didn't say that she'd checked with him twice earlier in the week if he would be okay, or that he was the one who made her switch salons because he didn't want her making friends, didn't want anyone knowing their business.
"I'm sorry,"
he mimicked her. He stared at her before shaking his head again.
"Christ almighty," he said. "Is it so hard for you to think about anyone other than yourself?"
He reached out, trying to grab her, and she turned, trying to run. He was ready for her, and there was nowhere to go. He struck fast and hard, his fist a piston, firing at her lower back. She gasped, her vision going black in the corners, feeling as though she'd been pierced with a knife. She collapsed to the floor, her kidney on fire, the pain shooting through her legs and up her spine. The world was spinning, and when she tried to get up, the movement only made it worse.
"You're so damn selfish all the time,"
he said, towering over her. She said nothing. couldn't say anything, couldn't breathe. She bit her lip to keep from screaming and wondered if she would pee blood tomorrow. The pain was a razor slashing at her nerves, but she wouldn't cry because that only made him angrier. He continued to stand over her, then let out a disgusted sigh. He reached for his empty glass and grabbed the bottle of vodka on the way out of the kitchen. It took her almost a minute to summon the strength to get up. When she started cutting again, her hands were shaking. The kitchen was cold, and the pain was intense in her back, pulsing with every heartbeat. The week before, he'd hit her so hard in the stomach that she'd spent the rest of the night vomiting. She'd fallen to the floor, and he'd grabbed her by the wrist to pull her up. The bruise on her wrist was shaped like fingers, branches of hell. Tears were on her cheeks, and she had to keep shifting her weight to keep the pain at bay as she finished dicing the tomato. She diced the cucumber as well, small pieces, lettuce too, diced and chopped, the way he wanted it. She wiped the tears away with the back of her hand and moved slowly toward the refrigerator. She pulled out a packet of blue cheese before finding the croutons in the cupboard. In the living room, he'd turned the volume up again. The oven was ready, and she put the baking sheet in and set the timer. When the heat hit her face, she realized her skin was still stinging, but she doubted that he'd left a mark there. He knew exactly how hard to strike, and she wondered where he'd learned that, whether it was something that all men knew, whether there were secret classes with instructors who specialized in teaching such things, or whether it was just Kevin. The pain in her back had finally begun to lessen to a throb. She could breathe normally again. Wind blew through the seams in the window, and the sky had turned a dark gray. Snow tapped gently on the glass. She peeked toward the living room, saw Kevin seated on the couch, and went to lean against the counter. She took off one pump and rubbed her toes, trying to get the blood flowing, trying to warm her feet. She did the same with the other foot before slipping her pumps back on. She rinsed and cut the green beans and put some olive oil in the frying pan. She would start the beans when the steaks went in the broiler. She tried again not to think about the phone beneath the sink. She was removing the baking sheet from the oven when Kevin came back in the kitchen. He was holding his glass, and it was half empty. His eyes were already glassy. 4 or 5 drinks so far, she couldn't tell. She put the sheet on the stove. "Just a little bit longer," she said, her tone neutral, pretending that nothing had happened. She'd learned that if she acted angry or hurt, it only enraged him. "I have to finish the steaks, and then dinner will be ready."
"I'm sorry," he said.
He swayed slightly. She smiled. "I know. It's okay. It's been a hard few weeks. You've been working a lot."
"Are those new jeans?"
The words came out slurry.
"No," she said. "I just haven't worn them for a while."
"They look good."
"Thank you," she said.
He took a step toward her.
"You're so beautiful. You know I love you, right?"
"I know."
"I don't like hitting you. You just don't think sometimes."
She nodded, looking away, trying to think of something to do, needing to stay busy, then remembered she had to set the table. She moved to the cupboard near the sink. He moved behind her as she was reaching for the plates and rotated her toward him, pulling her close. She inhaled before offering a contented sigh, because she knew he wanted her to make those kinds of sounds.
"You're supposed to say that you love me too," he whispered.
He kissed her cheek, and she put her arms around him. She could feel him pressed against her, knew what he wanted.
"I love you," she said.
His hand traveled to her breast. She waited for the squeeze, but it didn't come. Instead, he caressed it gently. Despite herself, Her nipple began to harden, and she hated it, but she couldn't help it. His breath was hot, boozy. God, you're beautiful. You've always been beautiful. From the first time I saw you. He pressed himself harder against her, and she could feel him.
Let's hold off on putting the stakes in, he said. Dinner can wait for a little while.
I thought you were hungry. She made it sound like a tease.
I'm hungry for something else right now, he whispered.
He unbuttoned her shirt and pulled it open, before moving to the snap on her jeans. Not here, she said, leaning her head back, letting him continue to kiss her. In the bedroom, okay?
How about the table? Or on the counter instead?
Please, baby, she murmured, her head back as he kissed her neck. That's not very romantic.
But it's sexy, he said.
What if someone sees us through the window?
You're no fun, he said.
Please, she said again. For me, you know how hot you make me in bed. He kissed her once more, his hands traveling to her bra. He unsnapped it from the front. He didn't like bras that snapped in the back. She felt the cold air of the kitchen on her breasts, saw the lust in his face as he stared at them. He licked his lips before leading her to the bedroom. He was almost frenzied as soon as they got there, working her jeans down around her hips, then to her ankles. He squeezed her breasts, and she bit her lip to keep from crying out before they fell onto the bed. She panted and moaned and called his name, knowing he wanted her to do those things, because she didn't want him to be angry, because she didn't want to be slapped or punched or kicked, because she didn't want him to know about the phone. Her kidney was still shooting pain, and she changed her cries into moans, saying the things he wanted her to say, turning him on until his body started to spasm. When it was over, she got up from the bed, dressed, and kissed him. Then she went back to the kitchen and finished making dinner. Kevin went back to the living room and drank more vodka before going to the table. He told her about work and then went to watch television again while she cleaned the kitchen. Afterward, he wanted her to sit beside him and watch television, so she did, until it was finally time to turn in. In the bedroom, he was snoring within minutes, oblivious to Katie's silent tears, oblivious to her hatred of him, her hatred of herself, oblivious to the money she'd been stashing away for almost a year, or the hair dye she'd snuck into the grocery cart a month ago and hidden in the closet, oblivious to the cell phone hidden in the cupboard beneath the kitchen sink, oblivious to the fact that in just a few days, if all went the way she hoped, he would never see or hit her ever again. Chapter 19. Katie sat beside Alex on the porch, the sky above them a black expanse dotted with light. For months, she'd tried to block out the specific memories, focusing only on the fear that had been left behind. She didn't want to remember Kevin, didn't want to think about him. She wanted to erase him entirely, to pretend he never existed, but he would always be there. Alex had stayed silent throughout her story, his chair angled toward hers. She'd spoken through her tears, though he doubted she even knew she was crying. She told him without emotion, almost in a trance, as if the events had happened to someone else. He felt sick to his stomach by the time she'd trailed off. She couldn't look at him as she told him. He'd heard versions of the same story before, but this time it was different. She wasn't simply a victim. She was his friend, the woman he'd come to love. And he tucked a loose strand of hair behind her ear. At his touch, she flinched slightly before relaxing. He heard her sigh, tired now, tired of talking, tired of the past.
You did the right thing by leaving, he said.
His tone was soft, understanding. It took her a moment to respond. I know, she said.
It had nothing to do with you.
She stared into the darkness. Yes, she said, it did. I chose him, remember? I married him. I let it happen once and then again. And after that, it was too late. I still cooked for him and cleaned the house for him. I slept with him whenever he wanted, did whatever he wanted. I made him think I loved it.
You did what you had to do to survive, he said, his voice steady.
She grew silent again. The crickets were chirping and locusts hummed from the trees. I never thought something like this could happen, you know? My dad was a drunk, but he wasn't violent. I was just so weak. I don't know why I let it happen. His voice was soft.
Because at one time, you loved him. Because you believed him when he promised it wouldn't happen again. Because he gradually grew more violent and controlling over time, slowly enough that you felt like he would change, until you finally realized he wouldn't.
With his words, she inhaled sharply and lowered her head, her shoulders heaving up and down. The sound of her anguish made his throat clench with anger at the life she'd lived, and sadness because she was still living it. He wanted to hold her, but knew that right now, at this moment, he was doing all she wanted. She was fragile, on edge, vulnerable. It took a few minutes before she was finally able to stop crying. Her eyes were red and puffy. I'm sorry I told you all that, she said, her voice still choked up. I shouldn't have.
I'm glad you did.
The only reason I did was because you already knew.
I know.
But you didn't need to know the details about the things I had to do.
It's okay.
I hate him, she said. But I hate myself, too. I tried to tell you that I'm better off alone. I'm not who you thought I was. I'm not the woman you think you know. She was on the verge of crying again, and he finally stood. He tugged at her hand, willing her to stand. She did, but wouldn't look at him. He suppressed his anger at her husband and kept his voice soft.
Listen to me, he said.
He used a finger to raise her chin. She resisted at first, then gave in, finally looking at him. He went on.
There's nothing you can tell me that will change how I feel about you. Nothing. Because that isn't you. It's never been you. You're the woman I've come to know. The woman I love.
She studied him, wanting to believe him, knowing somehow he was telling the truth. And she felt something give way inside her. Still,
no buts, he said, because there are none. You see yourself as someone who couldn't get away. I see the courageous woman who escaped. You see yourself as someone who should be ashamed or guilty because she let it happen. I see a kind, beautiful woman who should feel proud because she stopped it from happening ever again. Not many women have the strength to do what you did. That's what I see now. And that's what I've always seen when I look at you.
She smiled. I think you need glasses.
Don't let the gray hair fool you. My eyes are still perfect.
He moved toward her, making sure it was okay before leaning in to kiss her. It was brief and soft, caring.
I'm just sorry you had to go through it at all.
I'm still going through it.
Because you think he's looking for you?
I know he's looking for me. And he'll never stop.
She paused. There's something wrong with him. He's insane.
Alex thought about that. I know I shouldn't ask, but did you ever think of calling the police?
Her shoulders dropped slightly. Yes, she said. I called once.
And they didn't do anything?
They came to the house and talked to me. They convinced me not to press charges.
Alex considered it. That doesn't make sense.
It made perfect sense to me, she shrugged. Kevin warned me that it wouldn't do any good to call the police.
How would he know?
She sighed, thinking she might as well tell him everything. Because he is the police, she finally said. She looked up at him. He's a detective with the Boston Police Department, and he didn't call me Katie.
Her eyes telegraphed despair.
He called me Aaron. Chapter 20. On Memorial Day, hundreds of miles to the north, Kevin Tierney stood in the backyard of a house in Dorchester, wearing shorts and a Hawaiian-style shirt he'd bought when he and Aaron had visited Oahu on their honeymoon.
Aaron's back in Manchester, he said.
Bill Robinson, his captain, flipped burgers on the grill.
Again? I told you that a friend has cancer, right? She feels like she's got to be there for a friend.
That cancer's bad stuff, Bill said. How's Aaron holding up?
Okay, I can tell she's tired, though. Tired to keep going back and forth like she's been doing.
I can imagine, Bill said. Emily had to do something like that when his sister got lupus. Spent 2 months up at Burlington in the middle of winter, cooped up in a tiny apartment, just the two of them. Drove them both crazy. In the end, the sister packed up Em's suitcases and set them outside the front door and said she was better off alone. Not that I could blame her, of course.
Kevin took a pull on his beer, and because it was expected of him, he smiled. Emily was Bill's wife, and they'd been married almost 30 years. Bill liked to tell people they'd been the happiest 6 years of his life. Everyone at the precinct had heard the joke about 50 times in the past 8 years, and a big chunk of those people were here now. Bill hosted a barbecue at his house every Memorial Day, and pretty much everyone who wasn't on duty showed up, not only out of obligation, but because Bill's brother distributed beer for a living, a lot of which ended up here. Wives and husbands, girlfriends and boyfriends, and kids were clustered in groups, some in the kitchen, others on the patio. Four detectives were playing horseshoes, and sand was flying around the stakes.
Next time she's back in town, Bill added, why don't you bring her by for dinner? Em's been asking about her. Unless, of course, you two would rather make up for lost time.
He winked. Kevin wondered if the offer was genuine. On days like these, Bill liked to pretend he was just one of the guys instead of the captain. But he was hard-edged, cunning, more a politician than a cop.
I'll mention it to her.
When did she take off?
Earlier this morning. She's already there.
The burgers were sizzling on the grill, the drippings making the flames jump and dance. Bill pressed down on one of the patties, squeezing out the juice, drying it out. The man knew nothing about barbecuing, Kevin thought. Without the juice, they would taste like rocks, dry, flavorless, and hard, inedible.
Hey, about the Ashley Henderson case, Bill said, changing the subject.
I think we're finally going to be able to indict. You did good work there.
It's about time, Kevin said.
I thought they had enough a while ago.
I did too, but I'm not the DA.
Bill pressed down on another patty, ruining it.
I also wanted to talk to you about Terry.
Terry Canton had been Kevin's partner for the last 3 years, but he'd had a heart attack in December and had been out of work since. Kevin had been working alone since then.
What about him?
He's not coming back. I just found out this morning. His doctors recommended that he retire, and he decided they were right. He figures he's already put in his 20, and his pension is waiting for him.
What does that mean for me? Bill shrugged. We'll get you a new partner, but we can't right now with the city on a budget freeze. Maybe when the new budget passes. Maybe or probably. You'll get a partner, but it probably won't be until July. I'm sorry about that. I know it means more work for you, but there's nothing I can do. I'll try my best to keep your load manageable.
I appreciate that. A group of kids ran across the patio, their faces dirty. Two women exited the house carrying bowls of chips, probably gossiping. Kevin hated gossips. Bill motioned with his spatula toward the railing on the deck.
Hand me that plate over there, would you? I think these are getting close to being done.
Kevin grabbed the serving platter. It was the same one that had been used to bring the hamburger patties out to the grill, and he noted smears of grease and bits of raw hamburger. Disgusting. He knew that Aaron would have brought a clean platter, one without bits of raw hamburger and grease. Kevin set the platter next to the grill.
I need another beer, Kevin said, raising his bottle. You want one?
Bill shook his head and ruined another burger.
I'm still working on mine right there, but thanks.
Kevin headed toward the house, feeling the grease from the platter on his fingertips, soaking in.
Hey!
Bill shouted from behind him. Kevin turned.
Pool is over there, remember?
Bill pointed to the corner of the deck.
I know, but I want to wash my hands before dinner. Make it back quick, then. Once I set the platter out, it's every man for himself.
Kevin paused at the back door to wipe his feet on the mat before heading inside. In the kitchen, he walked around a group of chattering wives and toward the sink. He washed his hands twice, using soap both times. Through the window, he saw Bill set the platter of hot dogs and burgers on the picnic table near the buns, condiments, and bowls of chips. Almost immediately, flies caught the scent and descended on the feast, buzzing over the food and landing on the burgers. People didn't seem to care as they formed a crazy line. Instead, they shooed the flies and loaded their plates, pretending that flies weren't swarming. Ruined burgers and a cloud of flies. He and Aaron would have done it differently. He wouldn't have pressed the burgers with the spatula, and Aaron would have placed the condiments and chips and pickles in the kitchen so people could serve up there, where it was clean. Flies were disgusting, and the burgers were as hard as rocks, and he wasn't going to eat them because the thought made him nauseated. He waited until the platter of burgers had been emptied before heading back outside. He wandered to the table, feigning disappointment.
I warned you they'd go fast, Bill beamed. But Emily's got another platter in the refrigerator, so it won't be long until round two. Grab me a beer, would you, while I go get it?
Sure, Kevin said. When the next batch of burgers was done, Kevin loaded a plate of food and complimented Bill and told him it looked fantastic. Flies were swarming and the burgers were dry, and when Bill turned away, Kevin tossed the food into the metal garbage can on the side of the house. He told Bill that the burger tasted fantastic. He stayed at the barbecue for a couple of hours. He talked with Coffee and Ramirez. They were detectives like him, except they ate the burgers and didn't care that the flies were swarming. Kevin didn't want to be the first one to leave, or even the second one, because the captain wanted to pretend he was one of the guys, and he didn't want to offend the captain. He didn't like Coffee or Ramirez. Sometimes when Kevin was around, Coffee and Ramirez stopped talking, and Kevin knew they'd been talking about him behind his back. Gossips. But Kevin was a good detective, and he knew it. Bill knew it, and so did Coffee and Ramirez. He worked homicide and knew how to talk to witnesses and suspects. He knew when to ask questions and when to listen. He knew when people were lying to him, and he put murderers behind bars because the Bible says thou shalt not kill. And he believed in God, and he was doing God's work by putting the guilty in jail. Back at home, Kevin walked through the living room. He resisted the urge to call for Aaron. If Aaron had been here, the mantle would have been dusted, and the magazines would have fanned out on the end table, and there wouldn't have been an empty bottle of vodka on the couch. If Aaron had been here, the drapes would have been opened, allowing the sunlight to stretch across the floorboards. If Aaron had been here,
The dishes would have been washed and put away, and dinner would have been waiting on the table. And she would have smiled at him and asked him how his day had gone. Later, they would make love because he loved her and she loved him. Upstairs in the bedroom, he stood at the closet door. He could still catch a whiff of the perfume she'd worn, the one he'd bought her for Christmas. He'd seen her lift a tab on an ad in one of her magazines and smile when she smelled the perfume sample. When she went to bed, he tore the page out of the magazine and tucked it into his wallet so he'd know exactly which perfume to buy. He remembered the tender way she'd dabbed a little behind each ear and on her wrists when he'd taken her out on New Year's Eve, and how pretty she'd looked in the black cocktail dress she was wearing. In the restaurant, Kevin had noticed the way other men, even those with dates, had glanced in her direction as she passed by them on the way to the table. Afterward, when they'd returned home, they made love as the new year rolled in. The dress was still there, hanging in the same place, bringing back those memories. A week ago, he remembered removing it from the hanger and holding it as he'd sat on the edge of the bed and cried. Outside, he could hear the steady sound of crickets, but it did nothing to soothe him. Though it was supposed to have been a relaxing day, he was tired. He hadn't wanted to go to the barbecue, hadn't wanted to answer questions about Aaron, hadn't wanted to lie. Not because lying bothered him, but because it was hard to keep up the pretense that Aaron hadn't left him. He'd invented a story, and he'd been sticking to it for months, that Aaron called every night, that she'd been home the last few days but had gone back to New Hampshire, that the friend was undergoing chemotherapy and needed Aaron's help. He knew he couldn't keep that up forever, that soon the helping a friend excuse would begin to sound hollow and people would begin to wonder why they never saw Aaron in church or at the store or even around the neighborhood or how long she would continue to help her friend. They'd talk about him behind his back and say things like, "Aaron must have left him," and, "I guess their marriage wasn't as perfect as I thought it was." The thought made his stomach clench, reminding him that he hadn't eaten. There wasn't much in the refrigerator. Aaron always had turkey and ham and Dijon mustard and fresh rye bread from the bakery, but his only choice now was whether to reheat the Mongolian beef he'd picked up from the Chinese restaurant a couple of days earlier. On the bottom shelf, he saw food stains, and he felt like crying again, because it made him think about Aaron's screams and the way her head had sounded when it had hit the edge of the table after he'd thrown her across the kitchen. He'd been slapping and kicking her because there were food stains in the refrigerator, and he wondered now why he'd become so angry about such a little thing. Kevin went to the bed and lay down. Next thing he knew, it was midnight, and the neighborhood outside his window was still. Across the street, he saw a light on in the Feldman's house. He didn't like the Feldmans. Unlike the other neighbors, Larry Feldman never waved at him if both of them happened to be in their yards. And if his wife, Gladys, happened to see him, she'd turn away and head back into the house. They were in their 60s, the kind of people who rushed outside to scold a kid who happened to walk across their grass to retrieve a frisbee or baseball. And even though they were Jewish, they decorated their house with Christmas lights, in addition to the menorah they put in the window at the holidays. They confounded him, and he didn't think they were good neighbors. He went back to bed, but couldn't fall asleep. In the morning, with sunlight streaming in, he knew that nothing had changed for anyone else. Only his life was different. His brother, Michael, and his wife, Nadine, would be getting the kids ready for school before heading out to their jobs at Boston College, and his mom and dad were probably reading the Globe as they had their morning coffee. Crimes had been committed, and witnesses would be in the precinct. Coffee and Ramirez would be gossiping about him. He showered and had vodka and toast for breakfast. At the precinct, he was called out to investigate a murder. A woman in her 20s, most likely a prostitute, had been found stabbed to death, her body tossed in a dumpster. He spent the morning talking to bystanders while the evidence was collected. When he finished with the interviews, he went to the precinct to start the report while the information was fresh in his mind. He was a good detective. The precinct was busy. End of a holiday weekend, the world gone crazy, Detectives were speaking into phones and writing at their desks and talking to witnesses and listening as victims told detectives about their victimization. Noisy, active, people coming and going, phones ringing. Kevin walked toward his desk, one of four in the middle of the room. Through the open door, Bill waved, but stayed in his office. Ramirez and Coffee were at their desks, sitting across from him.
You okay?
Coffee asked. Coffee was in his 40s, overweight and balding.
You look like hell.
I didn't sleep well, Kevin said.
I don't sleep well without Janet either. When's Aaron coming back?
Kevin kept his expression neutral.
Next weekend. I've got a few days coming and we've decided to go to the Cape. We haven't been there in years.
Yeah? My mom lives there. Where at the Cape?
Provincetown.
So does she. You'll love it there. I go there all the time. Where are you staying? Kevin wondered why Coffee kept asking questions.
I'm not sure, he finally said. Aaron's making the arrangements.
Kevin walked toward the coffee pot and poured himself a cup, even though he didn't want any. He'd have to find the name of a bed and breakfast and a couple of restaurants, so if Coffee asked about it, he'd know what to say. His days followed the same routine. He worked and talked to witnesses, and finally went home. His work was stressful and he wanted to relax when he finished, but everything was different at home, and the work stayed with him. He'd once believed that he would get used to the sight of murder victims, but their gray, lifeless faces were etched in his memory, and sometimes the victims visited him in his sleep. He didn't like going home. When he finished his shift, there was no beautiful wife to greet him at the door. Aaron had been gone since January. Now his house was messy and dirty, and he had to do his own laundry. He hadn't known how to work the washing machine, and the first time he ran it, he added too much soap, and the clothes came out looking dingy. There were no home-cooked meals or candles on the table. Instead, he grabbed food on the way home and ate on the couch. Sometimes he put on the television. Aaron liked to watch HGTV, the Home and Garden channel, on cable, so he often watched that. And when he did, the emptiness he felt inside was almost unbearable. After work, he no longer bothered to store his gun in the gun box he kept in his closet. In the box, he had a second Glock for his personal use. Aaron had been afraid of guns, even before he'd placed the Glock to her head and threatened to kill her if she ever ran away again. She'd screamed and cried, and he'd sworn that he'd kill any man she slept with, any man she cared about. She'd been so stupid, and he'd been so angry with her for running away, and he demanded the name of the man who had helped her so he could kill him. But Aaron had screamed and cried and begged for her life and swore there wasn't a man, and he believed her because she was his wife. They'd made their vows in front of God and family, and the Bible says, "Thou shalt not commit adultery." Even then, he hadn't believed that Aaron had been unfaithful. He'd never believed another man was involved. While they were married, he'd made sure of that. He made random calls to the house throughout the day and never let her go to the store or to the hair salon or to the library by herself. She didn't have a car or even a license, and he swung by their house whenever he was in the area, just to make sure she was at home. She hadn't left because she wanted to commit adultery. She left because she was tired of getting kicked and punched and thrown down the cellar stairs, and he knew he shouldn't have done those things, and he always felt guilty and apologized, but it still hadn't mattered. She shouldn't have run away. It broke his heart, because he loved her more than life, and he'd always taken care of her. He bought her a house and a refrigerator and a washer and dryer and new furniture. The house had always been clean, but now the sink was full of dishes and his hamper was overflowing. He knew he should clean the house, but he didn't have the energy. Instead, he went to the kitchen and pulled a bottle of vodka from the freezer. There were 4 bottles left. A week ago, there'd been 12. He knew he was drinking too much. He knew he should eat better and stop drinking, but all he wanted to do was take the bottle and sit on the couch and drink. Vodka was good because it didn't make your breath smell, and in the mornings no one would know he was nursing a hangover. He poured a glass of vodka, finished it, and poured another before walking through the empty house.
His heart ached because Aaron wasn't here, and if she suddenly showed up at the door, he knew he'd apologize for hitting her, and they'd work things out, and then they'd make love in the bedroom. He wanted to hold her and whisper how much he adored her, but he knew she wasn't coming back, and even though he loved her, she made him so angry sometimes. A wife didn't just leave. A wife didn't just walk away from a marriage. He wanted to hit and kick and slap her and pull her hair for being so stupid, for being so damn selfish. He wanted to show her it was pointless to run away. He drank a third and fourth glass of vodka. It was all so confusing. The house was a wreck. There was an empty pizza box on the floor of the living room, and the casing around the bathroom door was splintered and cracked. The door would no longer close all the way. He'd kicked it in after she'd locked it, trying to get away from him. He'd been holding her by the hair as he punched her in the kitchen, and she'd run to the bathroom, and he'd chased her through the house and kicked the door in. But now he couldn't remember what they'd been fighting about. He couldn't remember much about that night. He couldn't remember breaking two of her fingers, even though it was obvious that he had. But he wouldn't let her go to the hospital for a week, not until the bruises on her face could be covered by makeup, and she'd had to cook and clean one-handed. He bought her flowers and apologized, and told her that he loved her, and promised it would never happen again, and after she got the cast off, he'd taken her into Boston for a dinner at Petroni's. It was expensive, and he'd smiled across the table at her. Afterward, they'd gone to a movie, and on the way home, he remembered thinking about how much he loved her, and how lucky he was to have someone like her as his wife. Chapter 21. Alex had stayed with Katie until after midnight, listening as she'd told the story of her prior life. When she was too spent and exhausted to talk anymore, he put his arms around her and kissed her goodnight. On his drive home, he thought that he had never met anyone braver or stronger or more resourceful. They spent much of the next couple of weeks together, or as much as they could anyway. Between the hours he worked at the store and her shifts at Ivan's, it wasn't usually more than a few hours a day, but he anticipated his visits to her place with a sense of excitement he hadn't felt in years. Sometimes, Kristen and Josh went with him. Other times, Joyce would shoo him out the door with a wink, urging him to have himself a good time before he headed over. They seldom spent time at his house, and when they did, it was only for short periods. In his mind, he wanted to believe it was because of the kids, that he wanted to take things slowly, but part of him realized it also had to do with Carly. Though he knew he loved Katie, and he grew more certain with every passing day, he wasn't sure he was ready for that just yet. Katie seemed to understand his reluctance and didn't seem to mind, if only because it was easier to be alone at her place. Even so, they'd yet to make love. Though he often found himself imagining how wonderful it would be, especially in those moments before sleep, he knew Katie wasn't ready for that. They both seemed to realize it would signal a change in their relationship, a hopeful permanence of sorts. For now, it was enough to kiss her, to feel her arms wrapped around him. He loved the scent of jasmine shampoo in her hair, and the way her hand nestled so perfectly in his. The way their every touch was charged with delicious anticipation, as if they were somehow saving themselves for each other. He hadn't slept with anyone since his wife had died, and now he felt that in some way he had unknowingly been waiting for Katie. He took pleasure in showing her around the area. They walked the waterfront and passed the historic homes, examining the architecture, and one weekend he took her to the Orton Plantation Gardens, where they wandered among a thousand blooming rose bushes. Afterward, they went to lunch at a small oceanfront bistro at Caswell Beach, where they held hands across the table, like teenagers. Since their dinner at her house, she hadn't broached her past again, and he didn't bring it up. He knew she was still working things out in her mind. How much she'd told him already, and how much there still was to tell. Whether or not she could trust him, how much it mattered that she was still married, and what would happen if Kevin somehow found her here. When he sensed she was brooding over such things,
He would remind her gently that no matter what happened, her secret would always be safe with him. He would never tell anyone. Watching her, he would sometimes be overcome with an overwhelming rage at Kevin Tierney. Such men's instincts to victimize and torture were as foreign to him as the ability to breathe underwater or fly. More than anything, he wanted revenge. He wanted justice. He wanted Kevin to experience Katie's anguish and terror, the unending bouts of brutal physical pain. During his time in the army, he'd killed one man, a soldier strung out on methamphetamines who was threatening a hostage with a gun. The man was dangerous and out of control, and when the opportunity arose, Alex had pulled the trigger without hesitation. The death had given his job a sobering new meaning, but in his heart, he knew that there were moments in life when violence was necessary to save lives. He knew that if Kevin ever showed up, Alex would protect Katie, no matter what. In the army, he'd slowly come to the realization that there were people who added goodness to the world and people who lived to destroy it. In his mind, the decision to protect an innocent woman like Katie from a psychopath like Kevin was as clear as black and white. A simple choice. On most days, the specter of Katie's past life didn't intrude, and they spent each day together in a state of relaxed and growing intimacy. The afternoons with the kids were particularly special for him. Katie was a natural with children. Whether helping Kristen feed the ducks at the pond or playing catch with Josh, she always seemed to fall effortlessly into rhythm with them, by turns playful, comforting, rowdy, or quiet. In this way, she was much like Carly, and he somehow felt certain that Katie was the kind of woman Carly had once spoken about. In the final weeks of Carly's life, he had maintained a vigil beside her bed. Even though she slept most of the time, he was afraid of missing those times when she was conscious, no matter how short they might be. By then, the left side of her body was almost paralyzed, and speech was difficult for her. But one night, during a brief lucid period in the hour just before dawn, she'd reached for him. "I want you to do something for me," she said with effort, licking her cracked lips. Her voice was hoarse from disuse.
"Anything."
"I want you to be happy." At this, he saw the ghost of her old smile, the confident, self-possessed smile that had captivated him at their first meeting.
"I am happy."
She gave a faint shake of her head.
"I'm talking about the future."
Her eyes gleamed with the intensity of hot coals in her sunken face.
"We both know what I'm talking about."
"I don't."
She ignored his response.
"Marrying you, being with you every day, and having children with you. It's the best thing I've ever done. You're the best man I've ever known."
His throat closed up.
"Me too," he said. "I feel the same way."
"I know," she said. "And that's why this is so hard for me. Because I know that I've failed."
"You haven't failed," he broke in. Her expression was sad.
"I love you, Alex. And I love our kids," she whispered. "And it would break my heart to think that you'll never be completely happy again."
"Carly,
I want you to meet someone new."
She struggled to take a deep breath, her fragile rib cage heaving with the effort.
"I want her to be smart and kind, and I want you to fall in love with her, because you shouldn't spend the rest of your life alone."
Alex couldn't speak, could barely see her through his tears.
"The kids need a mom."
To his ears, it sounded almost like a plea.
"Someone who loves them as much as I do. Someone who thinks of them as her own children."
"Why are you talking about this?"
he asked, his voice cracking.
"Because," she said, "I have to believe that it's possible."
Her bony fingers clutched at his arm with desperate intensity.
"It's the only thing I have left."
Now, as he saw Katie chasing after Josh and Kristen on the grassy shoulder of the duck pond. He felt a bittersweet pang at the thought that maybe Carly had gotten her last wish after all. She liked him too much for her own good. Katie knew that she was walking a dangerous line. Telling him about her past had seemed like the right thing to do at the time, and speaking the words had freed her somehow from the crushing burden of her secrets. But the morning after their first dinner, she was paralyzed with anxiety by what she had done. Alex used to be an investigator, after all, which probably meant he could easily make a phone call or two, no matter what he'd said to her. He'd talk to someone, and they'd talk to someone, and eventually Kevin would learn of it. She hadn't told him that Kevin had an almost eerie ability to connect seemingly random information. She hadn't mentioned that when a suspect was on the run, Kevin almost always knew where to find him. Simply thinking about what she'd done made her sick to her stomach. But gradually, over the next couple of weeks, she felt her fears ebb. Instead of asking her more questions when they were alone, Alex acted as if her revelations had no bearing on their lives in Southport. The days passed with easy spontaneity, untroubled by shadows from her prior life. She couldn't help it. She trusted him, and when they kissed, which happened with surprising frequency, there were times when her knees went shaky, and it was all she could do to stop from taking his hand and dragging him into the bedroom. On Saturday, 2 weeks after their first date, they stood on her front porch, his arms wrapped around her, his lips against hers. Josh and Kristen were at an end-of-the-year swimming party hosted by a kid in Josh's class. Later, Alex and Katie planned to take them to the beach for an evening barbecue, but for the next few hours, they'd be alone. When they finally separated, Katie sighed. "You really have to stop doing that."
"Doing what?"
"You know exactly what you're doing."
"I can't help it."
"I know the feeling," Katie thought. "Do you know what I like about you?"
"My body?"
"Yes, that too," she laughed. "But I also like that you make me feel special."
"You are special,"
he said. "I'm serious," she said. "But it makes me wonder why you never found someone else. Since your wife passed away, I mean."
"I haven't been looking," he said. "But even if there was someone else, I would have dumped her so I could be with you instead."
"That's not nice." She poked him in the ribs.
"It's true, though. Believe it or not, I'm picky."
"Yeah," she said. "Real picky. You only go out with emotionally scarred women."
"You're not emotionally scarred. You're tough. You're a survivor. It's actually kind of sexy."
"I think you're just trying to flatter me in the hopes I'll rip off your clothes."
"Is it working?"
"You're getting closer," she admitted, and the sound of his laughter reminded her again how much he loved her.
"I'm glad you ended up in Southport," he said.
"Uh-huh." For an instant, she seemed to disappear inside herself.
"What?"
He scrutinized her face, suddenly alert. She shook her head. "It was so close." She sighed, hugging her arms around herself at the memory. "I almost didn't make it." Chapter 22. Brittle snow coated the yards of Dorchester, forming a glittering shell over the world outside her window. The January sky, gray the day before, had given way to an icy blue, and the temperature was below freezing. It was Sunday morning, the day after she'd had her hair done. She peeked in the toilet for blood, sure she'd see some after she peed. Her kidney still throbbed, radiating pain from her shoulder blades to the backs of her legs. It had kept her up for hours as Kevin snored beside her, but thankfully it wasn't as serious as it could have been. After closing the bedroom door behind her, she limped to the kitchen, reminding herself that in just a couple of days, it would be over. But she had to be careful not to arouse Kevin's suspicions, to play things exactly right. If she ignored the beating he had given her the night before, he would be suspicious. If she went too far, he would be suspicious. After 4 years of hell, she'd learned the rules. Kevin had to go into work at noon, even though it was Sunday, and she knew he'd be up soon. The house was cold, and she pulled on a sweatshirt over her pajamas. In the mornings, Kevin didn't mind, usually because he was too hungover to care. She started the coffee and put the milk and sugar on the table, along with butter and jelly. She set his silverware out and placed a cup of ice water beside the fork. After that, 2 pieces of toast went in the toaster, though she couldn't toast them just yet. She put 3 eggs on the counter where she could reach them quickly. When that was done, she placed 6 slices of bacon in the frying pan. They were sizzling and popping when Kevin finally wandered into the kitchen. He took a seat at the empty table and drank his water as she brought him a cup of coffee.
"I was dead to the world last night," he said. "What time do we end up going to bed?"
"Maybe 10," she answered. She put the coffee beside his empty glass. "It wasn't late. You've been working hard, and I know you've been tired." His eyes were bloodshot.
"I'm sorry about last night. I didn't mean it. I've just been under a lot of pressure lately. Since Terry's heart attack, I've been having to do the work of 2 people, and the Preston case starts this week."
"It's okay," she said. She could still smell the alcohol on his breath. "Your breakfast will be ready in a few minutes." At the stove, she turned the bacon with a fork, and a splash of grease scalded her arm, making her temporarily forget the pain in her back. When the bacon was crispy, she put 4 pieces on Kevin's plate and 2 on hers. She drained the grease into a soup can, wiped the frying pan with a paper towel, and oiled it again with cooking spray. She had to move fast so the bacon wouldn't get cold. She started the toaster and cracked the eggs. He liked his over medium, with the yolk intact, and she'd grown adept at the process. The pan was still hot, and the eggs cooked quickly. She turned them once before sliding 2 onto his plate and 1 onto hers. The toast came up, and she placed 2 slices on his plate. She sat across from him at the table because he liked them to have breakfast together. He buttered his toast and added grape jelly before using his fork to break the eggs. The yolk pooled like yellow blood, and he used his toast to sop it up.
"What are you going to do today?"
he asked. He used his fork to cut another piece of egg, chewing. "I was going to do the windows and the laundry," she said.
"The sheets probably need a wash too, huh? After our fun last night," he said, waggling his eyebrows.
His hair was pointing in different directions, and there was a piece of egg at the corner of his mouth. She tried not to show her revulsion. Instead, she changed the subject. "Do you think you'll get a conviction in the Preston case?" she asked. He leaned back and rolled his shoulders before hunching over his plate again.
"That's up to the DA. Higgins is good, but you never know. Preston has a shyster lawyer, and he's going to try to twist all the facts around."
"I'm sure you'll do fine. You're smarter than he is."
"We'll see. I just hate that it's in Marlboro. Higgins wants to prep me Tuesday night after court finishes for the day."
Erin knew all of this already, and she nodded. The Preston case had been widely publicized, and the trial was due to start on Monday in Marlboro, not Boston. Lorraine Preston had supposedly hired a man to kill her husband. Not only was Douglas Preston a billionaire hedge fund manager, but his wife was a scion of society, involved in charities ranging from art museums and the symphony to inner-city schools. The pretrial publicity had been staggering. A day hadn't gone by in weeks without 1 or 2 articles on the front page and a top story on the evening news. Mega money, lurid sex, drugs, betrayal, infidelity, assassination, and an illegitimate child. Because of the endless publicity, the trial had been moved to Marlboro. Kevin had been one of several detectives assigned to the investigation, and all were scheduled to testify Wednesday. Like everyone else, Erin had been following the news, but she'd been asking Kevin questions every now and then about the case.
You know what you need after you're finished in court? She asked. A night out. We should get dressed up and go out to dinner. You're off on Friday, right?
We just did that on New Year's,
Kevin grumbled, sopping up more yolk on his plate. There were smears of jelly on his fingers. If you don't want to go out, I can make you something special here. Whatever you want. We can have wine and maybe start a fire, and I could wear something sexy. It could be really romantic. He looked up from his plate, and she went on. The point is, I'm open to whatever, she purred, and you need a break. I don't like it when you work so hard. It's like they expect you to solve every case out there. He tapped his fork against his plate, studying her.
Why are you acting all lovey-dovey? What's going on?
Telling herself to stick to the script, she pushed back from the table. Just forget it, okay? She grabbed her plate and the fork clattered off it, hitting the table and then the floor. I was trying to be supportive since you're going out of town, but if you don't like it, fine. I'll tell you what, you figure out what you want to do and let me know sometime, okay? She stormed over to the sink and turned the faucet on, hard. She knew she'd surprised him, could feel him vacillating between anger and confusion.